Hey everybody, I'm Rick Beato. I'm nerding out with Nate here on The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by VMGVinyl.com. Professional record cleaning, restoration, rejuvenation, and grading. Refresh your records with VMGVinyl.com. And with that, on with the show.
Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Testing, testing. Is this thing on? Oh, hey everyone. Happy New Year. Happy 2024 and all that stuff. Hey, guess what? I got a new theme song. That's new. Well, I'm not calling it a theme yet. I'm just trying new things, shake it up a bit, trying something new with the format. But that is a cool groove. Happy to have it at the top of the show for now. This is Nate here on the Vinyl Guide podcast. I'm here after a short break where I relaxed, listened to a lot of records, took the dogs to the beach, and overall just enjoyed some R&R time, which I hope you all did as well. And now I'm back in 2024 with episode 430 of The Vinyl Guide. And wow, what a kickoff to the new year. Rick Beato, musician, producer, YouTube phenomenon. He doesn't like the term YouTube influencer, which I understand. So let's just call him a YouTube phenomenon. Rick regularly breaks down songs and topics in music several times a week on his YouTube channel, and today he joins us here on The Vinyl Guide to cover a myriad of topics around records, analog recording, as well as the potential impact and challenges that artificial intelligence, AI, will pose on the future of music. It's a pretty fascinating chat, and he is absolutely the right guy to have it with. Rick just testified at a U.S. Senate hearing on AI and presented some interesting ideas, which you can find online. I'll link to the official transcript from the Senate in the episode notes. But yes, today, Rick and I talk about many different, potentially dangerous, definitely confusing impacts of AI and deepfakes on the future of music. And just so you know, we have an extended version of this interview available only to our Patreon legends, patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show. You'll hear more of this interview. Also, our episodes up there are in high resolution and they're commercial free. Plus, you get to help support your buddy Nate here and this show, and that is always appreciated. That's at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head over there now. And finally, if you are new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome to the show. Take a seat, grab a beer out of the fridge, and just want to let you know we've got over 400 episodes and interviews to enjoy, including episode 429 with Eddie Kramer, engineer of Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, and more. That's episode 429 of the Vinyl Guide. Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden joined us, episode 425. Peter Hook discusses the records of Joy Division, episode 412. Harry Farrell and Eric Avery of Jane's Addiction, episode 387. Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters, episode 382. Leland Sklar, bass player of just about everyone, episode 362, and hundreds more. And by the way, there's no paywall. These episodes are absolutely free for everyone to enjoy. Just follow The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app of choice and enjoy these conversations anytime, anywhere. And with that, let's kick off the new year with a discussion on analog, AI, and the future of music with Mr. Rick Beato.
Now.
Hold on.
And there we go. You can hear me now, right?
I can. I can hear you and see you.
Yes.
How you doing, Rick? Look, you got the Beato beard and everything going. Is this a new thing or a holiday thing?
This is, it started out as a holiday thing, but maybe it's a new thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
I look old.
We all do. I know. Well, that's, we call that dust on the roof wisdom.
So, yes. I like it.
Anyway, mate, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're so well known for your love of music and your education of music. And so many people around the world, including myself, appreciate that. I'm very curious in terms of vinyl in your life. You know, yep. What role do vinyl records play in your life these days?
So I have all the vinyl that I've ever bought in my life still from back in the 70s, early 70s when I started buying records. I still have all of it. Never got rid of one piece of vinyl. Mm-hmm. I've got a turntable that I use. It's a, what is it? Orbit Theory turntable. I run it through my, I have so many monitor speakers. Since I have a recording studio, I probably have 10 sets of powered monitors. Mm-hmm. I have unpowered monitors like NS10s as well, but I wouldn't say I have a proper stereo, so to speak. I will run my turntable into my Atom audio monitors, powered monitors, and use it that way. How often do I listen to vinyl and go to record stores? I don't know, probably every couple months or so I'll go to record stores. Vinyl, though, I listen to. I have things that I bought back in the 70s that are most of the stuff you can find digital versions of, but there's some jazz records, deep cuts, West Montgomery unreleased things that I have on vinyl that I can't find. There are some records that I literally you can't find the things. You can on YouTube now because people put them up there, but they're not good quality. So if I want to listen to something in particular, especially with jazz, my jazz albums, there'll be outtakes that were bootlegs that I got back in the late 70s or so when I go to used record stores up in Rochester.
Okay. So you said something interesting. You've never sold a piece of your vinyl. You have every single piece you've ever bought. Is that, I hear that right?
Okay. Yes.
And I'm sure there were periods of your life where you're kind of wondering where your next peanut butter sandwich is coming from, but you never considered selling the records.
Never. No.
Okay. Even when CDs came out, you didn't think,
No, I've never sold a CD either.
Okay.
I've never gotten rid of any, not a cassette tape, nothing. Anything that I've ever had. I have cassette tapes from the 70s that I recorded stuff off TV, off the radio. Still have them all.
That's interesting. Why is that? Because I would imagine, of course, in the 70s, being much younger, you'd be tempted to tape over things. Are you just an archivist by nature?
Yes. I would say yes. I have every record I ever produced. I have all the master files. I have every video I've ever made on my channel, 1300. I have all the files. I never go over anything. I have 300 hard drives. I've got stuff backed up in the cloud. I'm an archivist. I don't think of myself in that way. I just like to have the physical. I like to have the physical things. I mean, I had a stack of records. I had records that I just put in a stack now, which I don't like to do, but I was like, what are the closest records that were about 10 feet away from me? And, I've got Birth of Cool, and I've got Revolver, and I've got a West Montgomery Full House, and I've got, I have like a couple John Coltrane records, Weather Report, Heavy Weather, just stuff I've listened to in the past, a couple weeks or so.
Right.
That I want to listen to on vinyl because the dynamic range is so much better.
Is vinyl your preferred listening experience? I mean, you've got access to multiple digital Atmos, I imagine, when do you go to vinyl and when do you go to those other formats?
I go to vinyl when I want to actually hear things the way that they were initially meant to be heard. That's usually pre-1990 records, things that were actually mastered for vinyl that were all analog. Anything that was pressed off where the lacquer was cut off analog, something that was mastered for vinyl, to me, are the things that I prefer to listen to. They have way better dynamic range than even lossless things, if you listen to Tidal or whatever. When I listen to things that are from streaming services, Spotify or Apple Music or Tidal, anything, I belong to all these different streaming services. And invariably, as you go back, things that are remastered, and they're only mastered to limit the dynamic range, old albums that I have the actual LPs, and they sound terrible nowadays. I won't mention which ones. Pretty much all of them, the things from the 70s, especially, or the 60s, as they get, they just keep getting squished and squished and squished and squished, because if you put them in a playlist, they just sound quieter. right? But they also lose, they don't have the punchiness of the, anything with sharp transients don't seem to have the punch to them, and they just don't sound right. A lot of extra high end has been added. And then a lot of stuff that was mastered for CD release, records, you know, from, let's say 1990 on, they didn't really do a proper mix to be pressed on vinyl because it wasn't a, it was kind of a vanity thing.
Yeah, cause there were several albums that I was absolutely in love with. And I think of Rush and Iron Maiden, and I love those albums. When I got them on CD, they seemed just toothless. And yes. I thought, at the time, that must be me. Maybe my tastes are changing. maybe I don't like, you know, Permanent Waves as much as I used to. And it was only when I went back to the vinyl record and I found there's the magic. That's when it all became, I became aware of the remastering scenario.
So I had a 2-inch machine up until about 2 months ago when I permanently loaned it to a friend of mine who lives about 20 minutes from me. That's the first, honestly, the first piece of gear that I got rid of because it's 428 pounds. And if I try to shoot my control room back here, it was in the way of where I need to put the camera to do stuff, but I will get another tape machine. I'll probably buy a 2-inch 16 track or something like that. But yeah. I prefer to record to tape if I can, and then transfer to Pro Tools and work digitally.
The vinyl revival. Did you see that coming? Is that a surprise to you that people have gone back to vinyl in considerable numbers the past few years?
I don't think it's a surprise necessarily, because physical recordings are things that I think have meaning to people. People still want to own things. They want to be able to grab it and read it and hold it and put it on something. I don't want to equate it to buying a t-shirt, but there's something about listening to music on a streaming platform that makes it very disposable. Like you're just turning on a spigot. Okay, here it is. It all comes out and you don't hold anything. You don't really own it. Mm-hmm. You can't put your hands on it. You got to make four mouse clicks to hopefully get the credits. And then most of the time they're not even there. Like, who played on it? Who wrote the songs? Who's the producer? Who's the recording engineer? Who's the mastering engineer? I want to know all that stuff. And when I listen, if I'm streaming, or to me, this is a thing that vinyl, you have all this information and people mm-hmm. want to hold the things. And I think that if you love an artist, I think it's a way for people to get closer to the artist. That investment is, it's different than just listening by pressing a button. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that's why we never thought of it when we had LPs, you know, growing up and everything, or 45s, that was the only way you listen to music, or cassette. But now it's a closer connection with the artist and there's an experience of listening to albums. I don't know. I'm not surprised by it though.
Right.
I love that fact though.
Do you think vinyl is here to stay, or do you think this is kind of a blip on the radar?
No, I think vinyl's here to stay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there's a long period of time though where people that made records, you know, where the every step was analog, as I was saying earlier, we're kind of in this weird thing where, you know, records are made digitally that are made into vinyl. Even if they're mastered for vinyl, there's very little music that is analog all the way through.
It's a big effort to have analog all along the chain. Maybe someone like Jack White can do something like that, but very few artists can really even afford to do it, right?
Yes. When I listen to these old records that are, you know, 45 years old at this point, mm-hmm. They're all that way. They're all analog, recorded, mixed, mastered, and then put onto a...
They had no choice.
No choice. Yeah, but I see that, you know, a lot of artists, I think artists want to have physical records. That's a big thing. And it was a vanity thing for a long time where people would press, you know, major label artists, they press 300 of them or something, you know, and they'd send them to their fan club, whatever it would be.
Right.
So, but now it's more of a serious thing. It's like a really legitimate way to release music.
Majority of time I'll talk to people about vinyl and we use words like, oh, it sounds more warm. These sort of words that are very hard to quantify. Do you have a theory or even an answer on why humans tend to prefer vinyl when compared to digital formats?
I don't know if I can speak to other people, you know, how other people like to enjoy music, because so many people will listen on their phones and enjoy music that way. It seems very, very bizarre to me, but I think that there's something warm, you know, that's as good of an analogy as anything. It's why do I like to record to tape, especially bass and drums? Because of the way the transients sound, they just sound right to me. And some people say, oh, well, you get better transient response if you go in digitally. But if you really are hitting the tape hard, there's something about slamming the tape that gives it a particular sound and that I prefer. If I listen to Zeppelin 1, for example, and you hear the drums, and there's every snare drum, every kick drum has a little at the beginning of it. That's maybe an overloaded Mike Pre on the Helios desk, or it's hitting the tape machine really hard and it's giving a little bit of harmonic distortion on the beginning of every hit. And it just has a sound to it. And it's hard to describe, but it's the same. When I hear it on vinyl, especially, I hear those things and there's just a warmth. It's hard to find I don't have the words to find.
I've been looking for them for decades, so don't worry.
Right, right, exactly, exactly.
So, because on paper, you know, if you look at the math, I mean, digital should be superior in multiple ways. Even CDs, not let alone, you know, Atmos and everything else that's available, but people still tend to prefer vinyl. Do you think that is it mostly psychological at that point?
Depends on how old they are. You know, if I ask my kids, for example, I'll play a sine wave for my 10-year-old Layla. That's at 19,000 Hertz. That's long in my past. Mm-hmm. Was I able to hear a sine wave at 19K? She can hear that. Her experience of music is something that I can only imagine now at this point. So we all have our own way that our brain interprets music. Many famous mixing engineers are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they're able to still, when they may not have the best hearing, for some reason, their brains are able to make up for the deficits in their hearing because their brains are able to hear through these deficits they may have in certain frequency ranges and do incredibly good mixes. And I think about that a lot. I want to interview some mixers and ask about this, although a lot of mixers don't want to talk about their hearing, right? If they have any deficits. But the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of mixing engineers that have been in their 60s. Andy Wallace is a mixer that he mixed, mixed the Nevermind, but Rage Against the Machine's first record. He mixed Faith No More. He mixed a lot of huge records, a lot of the heavy rock records in the 90s and 2000s. Did Jeff Buckley Grace engineered and mixed, produced that record. And you know, Andy's still working. He's in his mid-70s, but did a lot of these records in his 50s, 60s, and they sound amazing. And you would say, how can a guy at that age do that work? Because he knows what to listen for. And the brain is able to interpret things even if the ears don't hear. And I don't know, maybe his hearing is perfect. I've never met the guy. I don't know anything about him, but these things fascinate me. Like, he'll go with kick drum sounds that'll have 2K on the attack of the kick, where they're not clicky. They sound very much like what an analog, what I think vinyl records kick drums sound like on vinyl records. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's something from him growing up and making records back in the 70s and listening to them, and he just likes that sound, doesn't like the clicky kick drums, even though he did a lot of metal records. But his metal records sound amazing because they don't have the same clickiness that a lot of metal records tend to have. And that may be from the way that he likes to hear the kick drum and the snare and things like that. So the way he hears transients, it's all in, you know, people that grew up listening to vinyl, I think, hear differently.
Do we have room in the future for another audio format? We've had physical form, digital, obviously vinyl. We've got tapes. We've now streaming, even Pono. Do you think that they think there's going to be something else in the future? Any thoughts on gaps? What do you think's missing?
Yeah, well, I think that there'll be some new formats that are around having surround video. So I had a friend that came in here that has a that's doing these 48 camera surround experiences where you wear the virtual goggles, and he had Buddy Guy, for example, playing guitar, and you could walk around him and see him on a 360, like literally like you're standing right there with him. Right. And then the audio, I don't think the audio was set up because they're just, they haven't even put this out yet, but the idea is to have the audio also follow around the person, kind of like Sonos or not Sonos, but Atmos, where somebody's playing guitar and singing, and they erase the microphones that are on there, and you know, you're playing and they're singing, and then you go around them and then you hear what it sounds like from behind them. And then they're going to have things where you'll be able to walk through the band and stand in the middle of a band as they're playing and hear what the things sound like, fully immersive. And this is 3 years from now, they're going to be able to do this. You know, it's coming. So I think there's a fully immersive experience that will be part of new formats that people listen to music in, because they're going to be listening and visual and using their, you know, have video involved with it.
You almost need like a motorcycle helmet type thing to immerse yourself in. So, so essentially we'll call that VR, music VR, because you're kind of projecting yourself into that.
Yeah.
With VR and AI, are you hopeful about that? Are you kind of weirded by that?
Oh boy, I have these conversations with my friends every day. Am I hopeful? I've said this on my channel before that there will be people that like AI generated songs. There just will be. They'll be stuck in a playlist on Spotify or whatever, and they'll be listening. Oh, I like that song. Have you heard that? And it'll be in the middle of other things that they're familiar with, and it'll sound kind of like that, and they won't know the band. And then eventually, after hearing it five or six times, they'll realize that, oh, this is AI generated. Wait, what? Why like the sound of it? And, you know, I have said this, there will be the Beatles and the Beatles AI and Drake AI and, you know, Wes Montgomery and Wes Montgomery AI. Maybe not that, but Nirvana.
I hope the programmers have enough taste to be able to include Wes Montgomery.
Right, exactly. Maybe not for certain artists, but there will be AI generated music that people enjoy. And I have no opinion on it. You know, but I know that people will.
Oh, you have an opinion on it. You have an opinion on it.
No, but my opinion is that people will like it. There will be certain things that people will like. Yeah. You'll be like, you know, that's actually not too bad of a song. I don't care if it was AI generated. Yeah, it does sound like the Beatles, or it's the Beatles AI. I prefer there will be people that will prefer, you know what? I really like the Beatles AI better than the Beatles. Like, what? I'm just thinking in these streaming services, Apple Music. Should I listen to the Beatles or the Beatles AI? Well, Apple Music's Beatle AI is way better than Spotify's Beatles AI.
Like, oh, you think it may go down even to the provider? Oh, why wouldn't it? I guess it's
why wouldn't it? Right?
Yeah.
Because the providers want to own these things so they don't have to pay. I mean, ultimately, the complete
Spotify's AI not artists, paying anyway.
So. They're not paying anyway. Right. So the AI artists that they own themselves, you know, the music that they own, if you can own it. I testified at this congressional hearing on AI. It was the seventh mm-hmm. of nine hearings recently. And, you know, one of my suggestions was maybe any things that are completely generative should have no copyright on them. Mm-hmm. You know, I got some pushback from some of the people that were on the panel that work in that business. They had professors, they had people from Spotify there, or a person from Spotify, the people from the Motion Picture Association. They had all these, you know, I don't know if you'd call them lobbyists, but they're people that work for these different entities that are
seeing AI with dollar signs, right?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they need to be trained on something. But, you know, then some people say, well, what's the difference between me if I'm go and listen to a bunch of, you know, Nirvana music, and then I write songs that are kind of like Nirvana? Am I being trained? Am I AI? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, what's the difference between those things? Well,
the soul.
The soul. Yeah. My human experience.
Yeah. To me, there are artists that are being manufactured now. I mean, they've been for years, you know, yes. and the music is designed for sale. I'm thinking K-pop and some of those very sugary, saccharine type pop songs. And they're designed to get people excited for 3.5 minutes.
Right.
AI, I think, you know, is very similar to that. It's taking all the different things that apparently humans like and trying to put that in a prepackaged format.
There are things that I think AI that can really be a benefit to that already exist. For example, editing. You have AI programs that will transcribe exactly what we've said. It'll take out the ums. It'll take out spaces. You know that you can do it very quickly, much quicker than you could do by hand. Obviously, now they have programs. Adobe Premiere has a thing that'll go through, and when a person speaks in an interview, it'll do the camera switches. Now that may seem like a small thing, but for me to go through an hour and a half, hour and 45 minute interview and do the camera switches is incredibly time consuming. Because you do it, do I change there? Then do I go back? Is there a reaction thing? You know what? So you're having to make all these decisions. And it can very quickly just go and go through in 30 seconds, do all the cuts, and then you just review it. Like, maybe we'll stay on it this way. But that, and I think for mixing of albums, AI will be very helpful. These things will put humans out of business, some humans. Color correction for film, things like mm-hmm. that, or for video. Things that will aid people in creating. But almost everything that's out on the radio nowadays has been touched by AI, at least in the putting into ChatGPT for lyrics. People just use it like they used to use rhyming dictionaries. It's just a thing now.
When you talk about the Beatles Now and Then, from what I saw of that, that wasn't so much AI. It was an AI tool that focused on frequencies. Yep. And helped the engineers EQ the
John's
stuff out
voice,
of
it. Separate John's voice, and then they overdubbed everything after.
Yeah, I almost wouldn't consider I wouldn't consider that AI. No. That's a tool. But
that's a tool.
Yeah. But at some point, there's going to be, you know, oh, here is a new fake Beatles song with words. In fact, it's probably already out there. There's probably a dozen out there. Have you found any Rick Beato clones or deepfakes? Up to this point?
No. Okay. No, but there are some great tools. There's a company called 11 Labs. There's a bunch of different companies, Moises.ai, but 11 Labs is a company that I put in probably about 20 minutes of dialogue, of my own dialogue into it to train the AI model. And it would mimic my voice. I could type something in, it would mimic my voice. It sound like me. But what was amazing is when it, after I trained it, I put in the audio of one of my videos. I put it into German. Okay. So it does 20 different languages or so. And my friend Aaron, who's German, listened to it. He said, oh my God, it's obviously me speaking. It sounds just like me. With, he said, it's you with an American accent with a perfect translation.
Wow.
Of what I said. And now they're doing, they have the beta thing is out where it actually will move your mouth. So it looks like I'm speaking German or whatever language.
Wow.
Insane. So, I mean, that's basically a deep fake that I can do. Is that a deep fake? I mean, I provided it the material. It's my own video, but.
Yeah. A self-induced deep fake, I guess. I mean,
it's right.
Kind of like the Kiss avatars, right? You know, they're controlling the destiny of it. I have no idea what that's going to look like, but I know it. It's very clear where the ownership is of that and the control of that. Same with what you just described there.
You know, Nate, I was fooled by a Tom Cruise deepfake. You probably have seen these things. There's a guy, Miles Fisher, that does the Tom Cruise deepfakes. And what he worked with some company. And so his hair looks like Tom Cruise's, and they replaced his face with Tom Cruise's face. But he did the voice himself. And I remember seeing this thing where he did this Dave Matthews song, Crash, playing guitar. He goes, people don't know that I'm a real big Dave Matthews fan. It sounds just like Tom Cruise. And he sings Crash. And I'm thinking, not only can Tom Cruise fly helicopters, he can play guitar and sing. What? And do a decent Dave Matthews copy. And then one of my friends is like, oh, that's a deep fake. And I couldn't believe it because it's so realistic.
Yeah. We always assume authenticity because there was not the technology or the means to be able to do anything convincing. Right.
Yeah.
But now that's in question. If we fast forward 5 to 10 years, how do you think media consumers, audio, video, how do you think we're going to be able to respond to that? Is anything AI, are they going to have a stamp on it? Are we going to know, oh, this is a fake Tom Cruise movie, right? But it's licensed by Tom Cruise. So is that acceptable?
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic to me. What will people do? Will people loan their voices and likenesses to these companies, these AI?
I can answer for Gene Simmons. Yes.
Yes.
It will be in beer commercials. It will be in every conceivable thing. Yeah. But someone like Tom Cruise, they would have to license their likeness, their imagery, even the estates of Gene Kelly and people like that, or John Wayne.
So I was thinking about this, Nate. I thought, okay, this guy that does the Tom Cruise deepfakes, he doesn't monetize any of the videos. And Tom Cruise has never taken any of them down because they're all really funny and positive. So let's say that this guy does a Tom Cruise deepfake, but he plays an original song of his own and it becomes a hit song. Is Tom Cruise entitled to part of the publishing, even though he didn't write the song? Because his image was the one that carried the tune to prominence and got people to listen to it.
Yeah, it's getting very twisted now.
Right. So, I mean, that's a way that you could use where somebody could actually write something and then use a deep fake to promote it. But yet it's an original composition.
And I would imagine at that point, Tom Cruise would have the ability to say, yes, let's keep that up there, but I'm going to get
50% of it.
Or 90% or whatever.
Probably 90%, right?
Right. So in this business, it's very easy to get cynical about things. And you seem to stay quite positive. How do you do that?
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, record collectors. There's a new service available that specializes in record cleaning, restoring, sticker removal, and professional grading.
VMGVinyl.com.
VMG Vinyl can help you make the most of your collectible records. From professional cleaning of records and sleeves,
removing old price tags and store stickers,
dry cleaning and rejuvenation of old shrink wrap to make it look like new, even providing you a professional play-tested third-party grade with either removable grading or encasing in plastic. You have a wide range of choices at VMGVinyl.com.
Buying a highly collectible record and you want it checked out by an expert?
VMG Vinyl can do that too. Head over
over there now and see what vmgvinyl.com can do for you and your collection. That's vmgvinyl.com, the one-stop shop for professional third-party grading, cleaning, and record restoration. That's vmgvinyl.com. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. So in this business, it's very easy to get cynical about things. And you seem to stay quite positive. How do you do that?
I think that when I hear something, doesn't matter of whether I heard it the first time in 1968 or last week. If I like it, I always have the same feeling. No matter how many times I listen to Kariba on this Wes Montgomery record, I have the exact same visceral reaction to it as I did the first time I heard it decades ago. Mm-hmm. So, and maybe that's why I am positive about things, because I just I always have that first time experience hearing things, even if I have listened to it a million times.
Still get the goosebumps.
Still do, yeah.
Wow.
Oh yes, it's yeah. I drive my kids nuts because I listen to the same drum fill, same guitar lick, vocal line, chorus, whatever, of a song that I've heard a million times. And I'll just listen to one little section over and over, or I'll hear something I never heard before. Even records I've listened to for 40 years, and I'm just stunned that I can hear new things in it.
Do you find yourself being distracted about dissecting the music?
No.
Or you could listen to as a whole piece without it being work.
So I never ever think about how to play a song, what the melody is, what the chords are, nothing, unless I'm going to make a video on it or unless I want to teach it to someone or play it myself. It never even occurs to me to analyze it. I just listen to music like anyone else. But when I switch this thing on in my brain, the analytical part of my brain, I can be like, yeah, A minor, G, F, E7, and I can instantly play it when I hear it. I know how to play the different parts. I know how to play the bass line, But, you know, there's songs that I've listened to for 50 years that I never have played and I enjoy, and I've never even thought about what goes into them. I just listen to it just like your average listener.
Okay. So you could compartmentalize very easily.
Absolutely. Yes. I never, ever think about the production or anything like that unless I have to explain it to somebody or how it's played or anything.
Okay. So when a song crosses over from kind of being on your casual listening list to the What Makes This Song Great series, how does that transition? How do you just, I'm going to focus on this song from Tool or whoever.
So there's a song, speaking of Tool or speaking of A Perfect Circle. So Billy Howardell, I talked to about, I wanted to do a breakdown, What Makes a Song Great, on the song Weak and Powerless. It's on 13th Step, the Perfect Circle record. Came out in 2003, I believe. Andy Wallace mixed that record. So I asked Billy, who's been on my channel before, I said, Billy, can I get the multi-tracks from him? He said, yeah. So he sent me the stems of it. Now, I never thought about how to play it. And when I got the things and I opened it up and put it in Pro Tools, I was stunned. These things that I've heard a million times, just to solo the tracks and listen to them. And then I could have figured them out, but I just never did. Mm-hmm. And I had even more enjoyment after I started doing the breakdown of the song. Of it gave me a deeper level of understanding of how to do it. What, not only separating the parts or hearing them separate, but then playing along and figuring them out. That to me is the is really the best part of doing these breakdowns.
How often in What Makes a Song Great do you get that level of insight? Multi-track stems? Is it
all the time?
All the time. Okay. All right.
Yes. Pretty much all the time. Yeah. There are things like, for example, in Ramble On, I did a breakdown of that, the Zeppelin tune. And there are things that you can't hear in the mix that are muted. There's some acoustic guitar things in the chorus. And you hear it on the recording. He's like, oh my God, is that what it's doing during that part?
Mm-hmm.
And the guitar sound, the acoustic guitar sound is so unique. And I have lived with it for decades. And then I was like, that sounds like a particular kind of acoustic guitar. And then I found this Vox acoustic that has a bolt-on neck, and I made a video about it to try and recreate that sound on my own and play along with it. And that really gives me even a deeper understanding, is to try and go in there and recreate these sounds after the fact, try and use the same microphones that they had, do the research, and then try and mimic them. To me, that's fascinating.
Now, in terms of your interviews, do you have like a white whale? Have you interviewed a Beatle yet?
I have not, no.
Okay. So I'd say probably McCartney, or who's the top of the wish list?
Oh, well, McCartney, Ringo, Jimmy Page, David Gilmour, somebody that you've interviewed, Tom Scholz from Boston, who I've tried to get in contact with for years. Oh my God, there's many, many, many people that I've not done yet. And will I do it before they're gone? I don't know. I do have a list of people, and if I get them, you know, if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Would I love to interview Paul McCartney or Ringo? Absolutely. I mean, that would be, you know.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Page and Pete Townsend, and, you know, all these people that I have tremendous respect for. My heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't happen, it's fine too.
Do you consider yourself a YouTube influencer? Does that feel right, rolling off the tongue?
I hate that, Nate. I hate that idea even. You know, when I first started my channel,
the bearded Kardashian.
Right. When I first started my channel, I was on the school board at two of my kids. I have three kids, two of my kids' schools. And I ran the academic committee, and I was on the committee that raised money for the school. Mm-hmm. And I had just started my YouTube channel, and I was going full time with it in 2016, 2017. And when parents would ask me, what do you do? What do you do? I'm a music producer. Because a couple of times I said, oh, I'm a YouTuber. And they're, what? You know, and I was way older than any of the other. I'm way older than any of my kids. Friend's parent, you know, my kids' friend's parents, and to say YouTuber, but now it doesn't, you know, doesn't feel weird anymore.
Right. YouTuber, because I've got young kids as well, and being a YouTuber is like the new rock star.
Well, for the kids think it's cool, but it's just weird for me to say, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I mean, right. You know, back in the day, we wanted to be rock stars. We saw these Jimmy Pages, and we wanted to be like them. They see Mr. Beast and kind of want to be like them. So do you watch, I'm sure you probably watch, but do you interact with folks like Todd in the Shadows or Anthony Fantano or any of those guys?
I've been on Anthony's, on his YouTube channel a couple times. A couple times, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One time. And I'll have Anthony on my channel. And I'll have you on my channel, Nate, if you'll come on my channel.
Ooh, I'd be honored.
But I only do in person. That's the thing with my interviews. It amazes me when I hear people that do, when I listen to podcasts, I always think to myself, when I listen to your podcast, I'm like, I could never do that. I don't know why. It just, to just have my voice there, I feel like that maybe the way that I communicate, because I use so many hand gestures and things like that, or that I need to have a guitar or something when I'm talking. Sometimes I'll tell stories, hold the guitar and never play a note because it's the security blanket or something, or it just feels right to have the guitar on. Even if I'm telling a story, it's like, why is Rick holding a guitar? Do I watch other YouTubers? Yes, I watch YouTube. I have a lot of friends that are in music YouTube, and I watch YouTube a lot. Yeah. I don't watch a lot of short form content. Well, I do watch some, but it's really, my feed is very, very strange because I have pretty eclectic tastes and things. So, as far as the, YouTube thing, yes, I definitely watch, and I learn a lot from watching other YouTubers.
Are you familiar with Pat Finnerty? What makes the song stink? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
He passes his regards, and he'd like for me to say to you, Beato.
Okay. Excellent. Yes. He says all the things I wish I could say. I'm not just kidding. No, I think that if I don't like a song, I wouldn't make a video on it. You know, I think it frustrates people that I find positive things to say about pop music, because I listen to things as a producer as well. And I know how difficult it is to make commercial songs that connect with a lot of people. There is an art to it. Even if it's stuff that I would never listen to, I can still appreciate stuff that is well done. And that frustrates some people that watch my channel. Like, how can you like that song? Or how can you say anything positive about it? And, you know, when something's well done, even if it's well done crap, there's art to it.
And there's a place for McDonald's.
There is a place for McDonald's. Absolutely. And I love to go to McDonald's occasionally, you know? So, you know, I like to, I have my guilty pleasures and stuff, you know?
When it comes to records, there's a lot of, you know, really bad record stores. There's a lot of, I think, subpar products. I won't, if someone's in the music industry, especially vinyl records, where really no one's getting rich, right? Everyone's trying to just kind of follow their passion, do something they love. If they've done something that I think is not great, I'm not going to kick them in the balls. I just won't say anything, right?
Right, exactly.
So probably the same path that you take. But then Pat Finnerty, he says it with such elegance, and I think...
Well, he's hilarious. And I, when I watch his videos, I think they're so funny, and I can totally enjoy that. Matter of fact, musical humor to me is the only things I ever remember from being a musician are the disasters at gigs. You know, what are my favorite music movies? Spinal Tap, you know, the things where music and humor are combined are hilarious. You know, that's some of the best humor there is, I think. So I appreciate Pat.
Do you have an album that you equate to perfection?
Yes.
Something. Okay. All right. Tell me about that.
John Coltrane, Johnny Hartman. Oh. They did a record. Lush Life is on there. It's wonderful, wonderful. So they say, I'm trying to remember what the track listing is on there. It's one of the most perfectly recorded records that is meant to be heard on vinyl, but it sounds great on CD or streaming. It's a perfect recording of John Coltrane's quartet with Johnny Hartman singing, and it's absolutely stunning. And I used to buy it for people, you know, as a present. If somebody was a music enthusiast, I'd say, have you heard this record? No. And I would buy it for them, as that would always be a gift. I'm looking up the track listing here. It's They Say It's Wonderful is the first song, dedicated to you, my one and only love, Lush Life, You Are Too Beautiful, and Autumn Serenade are the tracks. But it's John Coltrane, McCoy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison on bass, and Elvin Jones. And it's the most stunningly beautifully recorded record, the best vocal recording, and it sounds phenomenal. It's like a perfect recording of perfect renditions of perfect songs.
If I'm not mistaken, that was recorded by Rudy Van Gelder.
Yes.
And he
1963, March 7th, it was recorded.
He recorded so many great jazz albums. What is different about this one in particular?
I just, the playing, the sound of the saxophone, the air you can hear through Coltrane's, just the tone of the reed. Johnny Hartman's voice is just perfect. You know, it's a big Neumann U47 through, you know, whatever Mike Preece Rudy had in there. And it's just perfection. It's massive. The voice is engulfs your brain, you know, and the everything McCoy Tyner's voicings that he plays on it and Elvin's grooves. It's just everything about the record is just perfection. I interviewed Ron Carter a year and a half during the pandemic, and I asked Ron, because he made many records at Rudy's studio, and I said, and I asked him things like he played on the, you know, he was in the Miles second quintet, and then he played on some of the greatest records like Wayne Shorter's, what was the record? I asked him about Maiden Voyage, Herbie.
Juju?
And, no, he played, what was the record I asked him about? Anyhow, so I asked Ron about going over to Rudy's and how the bass sound changed, and would he ever go over to his studio when they weren't recording and work on bass sounds? And he said, yes. He said they if Rudy got a new microphone or mic preamp or something in there, Ron would go over with his two sons and they would play and they would move the bass around the room and check different mic distances and things like that. And they would try to always improve the sound of the bass on the records. And I just thought that was great that on their days off that he would do stuff like that, right? That And the bass sounds, you know, got better and better through that era, probably from guys like Rudy experimenting. You know, you get Ron to come over, and Ron said he would always get to the studio first and find his spot. You know, I'd asked him things like, how far apart did you guys stand on these Miles sessions? You know, did you wear headphones? Did you do this? Did you do that? Because when you're interviewing someone like that, these first person accounts, I mean, how many people were in the room on these particular records, you know, that can speak? How many people played with Miles that are still alive? Well, basically Herbie and Ron, that's it. Tony Williams is dead. Wayne is gone and Miles is gone. So there's to get these first person accounts.
Exceedingly rare.
That's right. And getting rarer all the time. But those Rudy Van Gelder recordings, that one in particular, Impulse Records.
Yep. That's the perfect album.
Perfect.
That's album. The one. That's the one. You see the warning sign, an asteroid is headed toward Earth. You have 1 hour. Of course, you're going to hang out with your family. But what record do you put on? It's John Coltrane, Johnny Hartman.
Yeah. I mean, as a record, as an experience, a sonic experience, I mean, it's the best thing Johnny Hartman ever did. I mean, it's such an inspired record. The song choices, and let's see, it was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. I mean, it's a... I always would give it to people, though. That's as a present.
Yeah.
That was my thing. It's like, you want to hear a perfect album that's perfectly recorded? You know, everything about it, all the songs are perfect. Here, listen to this.
Oh, I got it upstairs. I'm going to have to put it on after this. It's been a while since I've enjoyed that. So, Rick, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide and talking about records and audio and AI and the future of music. Your opinions carry a lot of weight, and I really do appreciate you making the time. I guess everyone knows where to find you. YouTube, rickbeato.com. Of course, you could probably just yell at the sky, Rick Beato, and something will fall out of it. That's interesting, no doubt. But Rick, thank you so much for coming on the show, mate. And I appreciate the wisdom and your continued stream of videos. And best of luck in 2024, man.
Thank you, Nate. Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, there he is. Mr. Rick Beato here on The Vinyl Guide. And by the way, if you're not subscribing to Rick's YouTube channel, head over there now and do it. He's always got really interesting stuff to say, really enjoyable videos. And man, what a nice dude. By the way, again, quick reminder, we've got an extended version of this interview only available to our Patreon supporters, patreon.com/vinylguide. You want to hear some more words of wisdom from Rick? Make sure to head over there now, patreon.com/vinylguide. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hey, do me a favor. Share these episodes on social media. Put them on Facebook. Tweet them out on X or Twitter, whatever they call it. You can do a TikTok dance if you want. That is always appreciated. And hey, by the way, we could use some positive reviews. Head up there to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And give your buddy Nate here a 5 out of 5. Say something nice. That is always helpful. and we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Follow The Vinyl Guide in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use and enjoy the full back catalog of episodes of The Vinyl Guide podcast. Thanks again for listening.
Yo, you still there? Did you fall asleep?
Yo, I get it. I fall asleep to podcasts all the time. But wakey, wakey, come on. We got things to do. Wake up. Let's go.